Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Louis Maestros, who's just completed a revised, expanded version of his wonderful novel, The Sound of Building Coffins. We'll also hear from poet Melinda Palacio, whose new collection is Bird Forgiveness. It's not often a novelist takes a second chance with a book, but then The Sound of Building Coffins is no ordinary book. First published in 2009, it's back in an expanded and revised new edition from Crescent City Books. Novelist Louis Maestros is here to talk about the rebirth of this fine novel. Louis Maestros, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. It's great to be here.
Now, you know I love this book. I did the first time around. I loved it this time around. So take us back to the beginning when you first got the inspiration for the Morningstar family and this really complicated story.
You know, it's weird because the book was kind of written backwards and then later on it was kind of written sideways, which is what this new edition is. But the first bit of the book that was written was the very last chapter, which is a narration of the character known as Marcus Nobody Special. And it's about his experience being buried during the yellow fever epidemic and then coming up with the rain. That was a short story that wouldn't stay out of my mind. It's like the characters were telling me they weren't done. And so eventually I sort of backtracked and did the rest of the book is practically a prequel in a sense. Mm-hmm. And so that was the origin of it. But the reason why it's longer now, it's when it was finally picked up by an agent. Well, the agent had recommended that it be shorter. It was much longer in the first place. So I had to basically cut it in half, which is painful. But when you take out huge swaths of a book, you have to plug in little patches here and there. And a lot of those patches were little chapters that turned out to be some of the most important parts of the book to me. So when I was approached by Crescent City Books to do a reissue and I suggested returning a lot of what was cut out, I had to put stuff back in while leaving in the patches, which was quite challenging to make that all work.
So what was it like for you to spend years with this book again?
I know, and it's like the book that wouldn't die for me because
right.
it was adapted into a theatrical production and
you've been inspired to write songs by it as well?
Yeah. And in fact, some of the songs that were inspired by this are going to be in a theatrical musical production that I'm working on called August Valentine.
So set the stage for us. Tell us a little bit about the Morningstar family and what's happening to them in this book. It's a complicated family.
It is a complicated family. And the thing is, there's magic in the family. It's a religious family. And they're poor, and they live on the outskirts of the city at the turn of the century. And so they kind of live in a swamp-type region. It's a bunch of siblings that they love each other, but they're all very different, and they all have very complicated things in their lives.
And Noonday Morningstar, the patriarch, has mm-hmm. named all of his children for different diseases.
Right.
So there's such a poetry in their names.
Thank you. You know, that's always the first thing that people mention is, why does he name his kids after diseases? And his logic is that diseases have pretty names.
Malaria.
Diphtheria.
Typhus.
Yeah.
They are great names.
And he sees them as a disease is a way to go on to reward without any fault of your own. So to him, it's like an innocent passageway to salvation. So that's his logic.
And you're also writing about one of the great figures in New Orleans music in this book, and that's Buddy Bolden.
Yes. Writing about Buddy Bolden, I was really ready to go in there and research that and get as much detail as I could. And as you probably know, the best book on the subject is by Donald Marquis, which really is a very thin book. There wasn't very much known about him. And most of what's in that book debunks mythology about him.
Right.
So it kind of threw open the door to fiction. That's one of the great things about New Orleans history, is it's so full of holes. And if you're going to write fiction about it, it's really kind of a playground.
You can either knit up those holes or you can enlarge them. I mean, absolutely. It's a really interesting process. Right. Well, I wonder if you'd read this very short chapter about jazz, which I think is so beautifully written.
I'd love to. Thank you. You know, this has always been one of my favorite bits. I think I need to set it up a little bit.
Sure.
What happens right before this chapter is Buddy Bolden gets his horn taken from him. And he's actually beaten up, and there's Buddy's blood is on the horn.
Right.
And this is the story of when the person who takes the horn goes to the river to wash the blood off of it. This is chapter 56. This is Blood. Just below the river's surface, smooth, white, sacred hands rub and loosen spots of red from the golden skin of Buddy Bolden's cornet. Upon liberation, the spots become wisps of red, mingling and joining together into a cloud of nearly invisible pink, lingering with residual longing near the hands that have freed them. When the hands have washed away every drop, the horn is pulled back quickly into the tacky warmth of living air. There is no song to comfort this thing, this cloud of faded, loose color. It must find its own, create its own. Thus delivered and abandoned by the exquisitely cruel hands, the cloud of pink is left to fend for itself in the great body of water. Locating its scent, tiny life forms are immediately drawn to the smell of it, investigating the possibility of nourishment with hungry, minute thrashes, giving the blood cloud its first bit of information, telling it that it can no longer stay in one place and survive, that it must move on, must avoid premature consumption, must deliver its message. This is blood. This is jazz. The pink is humbled by its own fragile existence, feeding only on the energy of its fear. It is fear that motivates it, fear urging to complete some unknown transformation or transaction, to become something brand new, something bold, a pocket of strength from a thing recently weak, a garment extraordinary from unremarkable plain cloth. The pink dives downward, elongating and thinning in shape as it accelerates, occasionally pausing to dance, to hesitate and waver, investigating, cautiously, gracefully, to trip and glide, to swoop and soar, to make its own way, to devise its own type of existence, joy, pain, heartache, triumph. Its initial sense of longing for familiar pain evaporates quickly as it grows accustomed to a freedom of movement it had never known in the veins of Buddy Bolden. Its form changes at whim of speed and current. There is no recklessness in this movement, for there is nothing to lose. It is a wondrous thing, this elasticity of form. The deeper it travels, the darker its surroundings become, and the more defined the lights. Lights. These are the lights of the dead. Souls unknown to blood. Unknown to blood. This song in utero. The cloud of red is no longer what it was. It has reached the spirit world. It is home at last. Through water it will touch the world. Its time will come soon. It cannot die. But immortality carries a price. What is sacrificed is a thing newly absent from the soul of Buddy Bolden.
I love that.
Thank
it's a
you.
Perfect poem. You know what I mean? It's.
You know, I tried to write this book as kind of a poem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've had the rare opportunity of seeing this book come to life on the stage. So what was it like for you to adapt it for that art form and see it unfold before
you? It was really something, because the actors that I got to work with were so good, and they brought their own personalities and style to it. And it was tempting to say, that's not how I imagined it. What they were doing was all on instinct, and it worked. So it was really interesting to see my words being brought to life in a way that wasn't expected for me. But it was a really enjoyable thing. That's why I'm working on this musical now. I feel like mm-hmm. I've got the stage bug now.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
All
this
right.
Could be a problem.
Well, now I understand you're going to sing one of the songs for us.
Yes.
That's been inspired by this book.
This song was actually, it's got a little bit of a history to it. It was actually written during the Hurricane Katrina evacuation. So I wrote it without a guitar because I didn't have a guitar with me. It was just something I had to get out of my system. It's called Go Down Water. And at the time that it was written, the waters in the city were still
right
up. So, and it was day after day, you turn on the news and you're hoping for good news. And it just wasn't happening. So this song just kind of tumbled out. A few years after The Sound of Building Coffins came out, a guy named Papa Molly, local musician, recorded a version of it and brought in some wonderful legendary New Orleans musicians like Johnny Vodakovich to play on it. And it was a real thrill. And then it wound up in a soundtrack to a film called Dancing in the Water. But now it's going to be a centerpiece of this play that I am putting together. So... to the other side, go down, go down water to the other side, go down, don't top the levee, then you broke on through. I don't want any more trouble with you. Down water to the other side, go down, go down water and arise no more, go down, go down water, let me see my flow, go down. Somebody tell me, please, where is my Lord? While the devil's taking souls from door to door. Go down water and arise no more. Go down. Go down water, let my children come home. Go down. Water, now I'm all alone, go down, go down water, this is all I own, don't let the devil take my body to the Superdome, go down water, let me stay in my home, I said go down. Chantilly to Chalmette, go down. Go down, water, ain't you finished yet? Go down. Go down, water, while we still have time. The clock is ticking on the people in the lower nine. Go down, water. Still have some time, I said go down. Go down water for 100 years. Go down. Go down water, wash away my tears. Go down. Goddamn water and a crowd of fears, and goddamn the Army Corps of Engineers. Go down water for 100 years. Go down, go down, go down, go down.
So a book that comes with a soundtrack.
This book is definitely a music-based book. The rhythm of it and the composition of it is very musical in its form. And that's basically how I learned to write was I wrote songs before I wrote fiction. So it all kind of ties in for me.
Well, that explains that poet's voice right there, you know?
Oh, well,
songs
thank you.
First. So we've been talking with Louis Maestros, who's the author of the newly revised and expanded novel, The Sound of Building Coffins. You can meet him Thursday, July 19th at 6 at Octavia Books. Louis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise.
Melinda Palacio is a poet who divides her time between New Orleans and Santa Barbara. I think she has the best of both worlds. She's the author of a poetry collection, How Fire is a Story Waiting, a novel, Ocotillo Dreams, and today we're talking about her new poetry collection, Bird Forgiveness. Melinda, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you for having me again. It's always a joy being
for
here
me
with
too.
You.
Now, this book is totally about the connections between us and the natural world, and of course, forgiveness. So I'm kind of curious. I always wonder how poets come up with whole collections. So you were writing poems about these things for a long time. So how did you know this was going to shape into Bird Forgiveness?
It wasn't so much that I had this idea to shape the book from the start. This book started, I read in Phoenix. I was invited to read at a show responding to artwork. And so I drove to Phoenix and I read the poem that in response to this phonograph. It was a sculpture of a phonograph made with recycled parts.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, just chains from a bicycle, cans. And after I read, the publisher, Andrea Watson of Three Towers Press, came up to me and said, I want to publish your next book. And being the prepared writer that I am, I said, sure, great.
Of course.
And I started sending her the poems, and it just so happened that I was on this theme of birds. And at first I thought, oh, I'm just going to do a chapbook. But she really encouraged me to do a full-length book.
Keep on pushing.
Yeah. And we developed this, you know, beautiful relationship that's sort of old-fashioned between the editor and the writer, where I'd send her some poems and she'd send comments back. And together we settled on just focusing on the bird poems mainly.
That sounds pretty ideal.
It is. It is. I feel so very fortunate in so many ways.
Tell us about the inspiration for this, because you had a very unusual set of experiences with birds for a while.
I did. And this started in New Orleans when we lived on Carondelet. Mm-hmm. And a young cardinal fell out of the tree, landed dead at my feet.
Oh.
It was a shocking experience that made me take notice of the birds around us everywhere. And then, as if the universe was giving me, you know, signals like, pay a little bit more attention. You're not quite paying enough attention. It happened again in Santa Barbara with a yellow finch. That just plop, landed at my feet dead. And then again with a beautiful little scrub jay. So when some larger force tells you pay attention, you do.
Three times.
Yeah.
3 times at least.
Yes. And so that's how the idea of bird forgiveness started.
And the thing is, you live in two places that are full of birds.
Yes.
I mean, so many birds. But I have to tell you, when I picked up this book the first time, I thought, okay, bird forgiveness. Well, are we forgiving the birds or the birds forgiving us? You know, I have a tangled relationship with birds. I mean, myself.
Okay.
So, so I have mixed feelings about birds, but this book really won me over in a lot of ways. So I wonder if you talk a little bit about the idea of bird forgiveness and read the title poem for us.
Yes, I'd love to read the title poem. And the title poem also started when I read at Beyond Baroque, and Beyond Baroque is where all the poets read in Venice, California. I noticed that all four poets had birds coming into their poems, and they all involved this theme of forgiveness. And I think that really set the tone for the entire book, even though the book is divided into four sections. It would be better explained if I read it, so bird forgiveness. Forgiveness begins with a bird for Alicia. Her pigeon flies through thin jail bars in Argentina, a skinny symbol of humanity, not big enough for a meal. For Ramon, forgiveness begins with a mockingbird lost in Ramon's seventh floor downtown loft, as if to tell him life in L.A. is redundant. The second struggle fools the bird as furious bones and wings flutter in Ramon's cupped palms. For Chole, her bird is a beloved niece, the girl gone the way of the thorn bird who sings, "I'm okay" in Farsi. No bird language needed when a suicide of words fails. Her way out, deed done. For me, forgiveness begins with dead birds at my feet. Beautiful bird bodies blur. First, a red cardinal's baby bird hush. A soft winter landing. Then a yellow finch plops hard on concrete. I fling bird bodies to the wind and trash. I was supposed to save their feathers, shield their tender corpses from the calico cat, bury them for safekeeping. I was supposed to do more. Forgive me, birds.
Oh, Melinda, I love that poem.
Oh, thank you.
Now, we live in a place where we're constantly thinking about the environment. We're constantly thinking about birds because they are everywhere. And you live in a house you call the Birdhouse near Audubon Park. So you're seeing birds all the time. So did you feel like once you got to work on this book, you were attracting symbols and images to work with?
Yes, it's as if working on the poems created a spell that conjured, that brought the birds to me. And as I said earlier, I really started to notice, you know, just looking outside my window, you know, in my office, there's a pink crepe myrtle here in New Orleans, and all kinds of birds land there, you know, eastern bluebirds, mockingbirds, crows.
I know.
Cardinals.
I think of Uptown as the land of crows.
I just noticed more and more the birds just inches away from me. I didn't really have to work hard to find them.
You don't keep birds yourself. You don't keep birds in cages.
No, I don't. I don't. My grandmother did.
And you write about that in this book.
Yeah.
And a lot of the tension in the poems comes from beauty that is caged and beauty that is free, doesn't it?
Yes. All my life, I grew up with caged birds. When Steve and I were living in Point Capee in New Roads, I saw friends that they had a relationship with birds. They had cardinals and that were sort of theirs, but they didn't need to keep them in cages. Mm-hmm. They were just in the bird feeders. I just thought that's how our relationship to birds should be, you know, have this friendly relationship, but not keep them caged up. Who wants to be caged?
Right.
So, and being in two places that have had severe oil spills and seeing all of the images of pelicans just soaked, soaked in oil just also gave me an awareness of our responsibility to the environment and to birds and the earth in general.
Their world is fragile, you know? Our world is too.
Yes.
Now, one of the things we were talking earlier, you go to the Santa Barbara Writers Conference every year, and this year you gave a workshop on writing in fear. And I wonder, did you have to conquer any fears of your own in this book? Did writing Bird Forgiveness advance you in a particular direction in your work? Did it move you forward in some way?
I think every book conquers that inner fear, inner doubt. You're always wondering, at least for myself as a writer, am I good enough? Am I a strong enough writer? Will this book be something that everyone I know can be proud of? And it was difficult writing some of the poems, especially What the Birds Know, the poem about my grandmother. I spent a month taking care of her before she died. And that was one of the most difficult things I have ever done. But, you know, someone reminded me, well, she changed your diapers when you were a little, right. little and you could change hers now. You know, so.
Well, it wasn't just the work of a person. It was the work of a poet, too. It all came together in that beautiful poem, I think.
And anyone who can see Elvis in a bluebird is all right with me.
Yep, blue suede shoes.
That made my whole day. We've been talking with poet Melinda Palacios, whose new book is Bird Forgiveness. You can meet her Wednesday, July 25th at 6 at Octavia Books. Melinda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Lexi Ostro signs A Heavenly Kind of Love, Sunday, July 15th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. Bill Lofelm signs the paperback of The Devil's Muse, and William Boyle signs The Lonely Witness, Monday, July 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Louis Maestros discusses and signs The Sound of Building Coffins, Thursday, July 19th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Dogfish Reading Series presents poet Jerrica Marchand and novelist Nathaniel Rich, Thursday, July 19th at 7 at 2448 North Villery. Judith Bonner and Thomas Bonner Jr. discuss their new edition of Sherwood Anderson and Other Famous Creoles, Thursday, July 19th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses Nobody's Fool by Richard Russo, Saturday, July 21st at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Kim Vosdeville celebrates the release of Walking Ratty, The Baby Dolls of New Orleans, Sunday, July 22nd at 2 at the Xavier University Administration Building. The Not-So-YA Book Club discusses Children of Blood and Bone by Tomi Adeyemi, Monday, July 23rd at 6 at Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop. Blaine Roberts and Ethan J. Keitel discuss and sign Denmark Vesey's Garden, Slavery and Memory in the Cradle of the Confederacy, Tuesday, July 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Melinda Palacio signs her poetry collection, Bird Forgiveness, Wednesday, July 25th at 6 at Octavia Books. Coming up August 4th at the East Bank Regional Library is the Tricentennial Literary Festival. Save the date. It's all free. You can hear speakers like Pat Brady talking about Outsiders' Leocadia Hearn and Frances Parkinson Guise, Emily Toth talking about Kate Chopin's Secrets, Cynthia Lejeune Nobles talking about Ignatius J. Riley, A Very Lucky Dog. I'll be there too. And don't forget, the Friends of the New Orleans Public Library continue their book sales all summer. You can visit Algiers Regional Library Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., Ladder Library Wednesdays and Saturdays from 10 to 2 in the Carriage House, or at the Palmer Arts Market the last Saturday of each month from 10 to 4. Join us for the Tricentennial Reading List every Tuesday at 8:44 a.m. and 5:44 p.m. The Tricentennial Reading List is brought to you by the Hellas Foundation, the John Burton Harter Trust, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. ¶¶